Welcome to the Behind the Racket Pod, the podcast taking you behind the racket with today's top tennis players and biggest issues facing the sport.
Behind the Racket is a community to give fans and players in the world of tennis the opportunity to open up like they have never done before.
Visit BehindTheRacket.com for the latest stories, merch, as well as direct links to all of the latest podcasts. It can also be found on iTunes, Google Play, Pandora, Stitcher, and wherever you find your podcasts. Download the episodes and make sure to leave a review.
And we want you to be a part of the conversation. Find me at NoahRubin33 or Mike at MikeCTennis on all forms of social media. You can also learn more at BehindTheRacket.com or MikeCTennis.com.
Special thanks to my sponsor, New Balance. Visit their latest shoes and styles at NewBalance.com and learn more about their program of giving back at #NBGivesBack.
You can also help support the podcast by visiting patreon.com/BehindTheRacketPod and receive rewards from our travels around the world. And now,
well, we are really delighted to have this guest, mostly because we haven't had too many Europeans lately to give us an idea of, you know, we've been American-centric, but we're happy to have with us the king of the abs, the man who flicked off the future king of England a week ago in Andy Murray. Liam Brody joins us, and Liam, let's start with that. It made the rounds on social media a week ago during the Battle of the Brits. You, on the British Broadcasting Corporation, flicked off with the middle finger Sir Andy Murray, and why would you do that?
First and foremost, I'd say because he deserved it. Man, it's been crazy over here. So we obviously had Battle of the Brits, the individual event, which was just run fantastically well. I played absolutely awful, and I was getting hazed like you cannot believe, from the best players this country's pretty much ever seen, which was just a horrible experience. And I just had nothing to back it up with because I played so bad. And then, you know, was then just getting it constantly for, like, you know, we now have a group chat with all of these British players in, and just getting abused constantly for like 3 weeks. And then built up to this team event that, you know, Jamie Murray and his team put together as well. And it was just amazing, man. It's probably the closest I'll ever get to a college atmosphere. The difference was, instead of frat boys shouting when you've double faulted, it's Andy Murray telling you how terrible you are and running on court with a dustpan and broom to clean up your rubbish, as you're saying. And then, you know, you guys know what Ebo's like as well. You know, Dan Evans is going crazy inside. And just, again, for the whole week, I was just getting horrific abuse. I mean, I did kind of deserve it because I was giving it out even worse than I was getting it. And then on the last day, I managed to get the win while getting abused for 2 hours straight from Dan and Andy. And I kind of forgot. I'm not going to say that I forgot. I knew I was on TV. But I wanted everyone to know what I thought of Andy that day. So.
The banter, I've gotten used to it in, when Marcus Willis, during, you know, that infamous time, it was him and Joshua Milton and some of the other guys. Yeah. And then
Cartman.
And then in you, as you well know, in Aptos over the years, whether it's you, Evo, Cam a few years ago, all of those guys, just the constant banter. What is it about the Brits that leads itself or lends itself to the constant banter during the sport?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think obviously as a whole, British people probably have quite a dry sense of humor and have quite a cutting sense, you know, quite a cutting sense of humor where you kind of revel in insulting other people and making them feel bad. like my sister, you know, if I stub my toe, she'll find it hilarious, you know, and I'll be in agony and she'll be in tears of laughter. It's funny because I think the American sense of humor is so different, but the Aussie sense of humor is probably pretty similar to the British. But it was really strange because it ended up making actually for pretty amazing viewing.
Yeah.
Because the microphones were quite close to the court, so you can hear a lot of the comments. And obviously everyone knew that it was in good humor. But obviously when you're missing balls and you're getting that, it's still, you know, when you're on court, you're still getting angry. So you're having to like pretend that you're not angry at me because the second you throw a racket, they know they've got you and they go 10 times worse.
You know, Mike and I during this time have talked about kind of experimenting. You know, this is the perfect time to just to try out different things on the court. I mean, does tennis need more of this?
Do you know what? It's funny because after this event, I think number one, there needs to be more mixed events. I'm very pro women's rights within the sporting world, as you guys both know. I probably would have said in the past, kind of keep the men's and women's tours separate but equal. Whereas after this week, it was so much fun.
Mm.
And, you know, getting so involved in the girls' matches and especially in team events, because it kind of comes like a, you know, like a soccer game, like a football game where, and the girls were brilliant. They stepped up to it. And especially in the mixed doubles, you know, Andy's like, like giving chat to some of the girls and they're just standing up to it and playing amazing tennis. And it just worked brilliantly, and I've not played an event before that had that kind of spirit. I mean, I think that would be a massive, massive. I mean, it was kind of worse than Davis Cup in a sense that it's so personal that the abuse you're getting, you know, it's not just loud noise. It's like very personal abuse.
It cuts deep.
But you get so into the matches, like. A few of us are there for 8 hours a day watching five matches in a row.
Right.
Just because it's so much fun to spectate and actually feel like you're having an influence in the match. And I think if tennis players were kind of told, look, you're going to get heckled like you can't believe out there and you've just got to accept it, and it was the same for both, I think it would bring something new to the sport.
So how do you incorporate that into a regular event, a regular capability, so people are still able to accumulate points within the ATP, WTA, and still do that?
I don't know. Maybe it kind of becomes like in football, how you have home and away games.
Mm.
You know, so if you're playing a challenger in America, you kind of have to accept you're going to get the abuse more than an American guy. You know, but on the same hand, when they come over to England or to France, you know, then you have a bigger home advantage. Because I've always kind of felt that in tennis, there's never really that much of a home advantage except for Davis Cup, really, which I've always felt like could be a little bit different to make it a bit more interesting. And I know that the game of tennis is seen as a very proper sport, but, I mean, the guys were all taking it fantastically. You know, the guys and the girls were taking it so well, so graceful in defeat and in victory. And it, you know, once the matches were done, it was all smiles and handshakes and obviously social distance handshaking. But it was fantastic. And like I said, like you're so much more invested in the matches.
You talk about, you know, your English. You have one of the most quote unquote proper tournaments in the entire world at Wimbledon. One, do you ever see them kind of changing their protocols and how they run that event, and also, how do we get the fans involved? Is it the heckling? Is it something new? How do we get the fans involved more than ever?
Well, I mean, one of the best atmospheres I've ever seen on center court at Wimbledon was Andy playing in the 2012 Olympics.
Mm.
And that was because it wasn't your regular tennis crowd. Because,
right.
You know, obviously the tickets are allocated randomly for the Olympics. So you might get the velodrome or you might get the tennis. So it was random fans that were just probably kind of had less of an idea about the etiquette of a tennis match and were just going crazy. But it was electrifying, the atmosphere. And
yeah.
I think we need to get more people into the sport like that. And we need people to kind of start realizing the more noise you make, the better. You don't have to be prim and proper. And I mean, that's kind of a part of the charm of Wimbledon, right? That's what Wimbledon is. It is that sort of civilized slam. But, for the players as well, you know, Noah, you know this, like the better, the more noise on the court, the better the atmosphere. And I think that would bring people into tennis more, feeling like they could get more involved. But that was just my experience anyway.
Yeah, there's nothing like Liam Brody doing like a banana passing shot with the lefty forehand, and there's just like three fucking people clapping in the audience. You're like, what am I doing out here? You're like, what?
One's my coach and one's my patient.
And for some reason, right after you hit it, you always stare at me like I'm supposed to interact with you. And I'm trying to do my damn job here.
Just making sure you're still awake.
So obviously you mentioned the social distancing aspect, and we're all kind of dealing with that right now. And that's one of the reasons we wanted to talk to somebody over in Europe right now. It's obviously quite dire here in the States in terms of, you know, for example, Noah's ability. He can't play challengers right now because there aren't any in the States. There are some in Europe right now. You mentioned that Great Britain, the United Kingdom, has one of the worst situations when it comes to COVID, especially in Europe. How are the travel restrictions impacting you? How are you able to play at all right now?
I mean, to be honest, I have no idea what it's going to be like coming back to the UK. But I'm 90% sure right now that if I fly to another country in Europe, I'll be okay. I'm going to play the challenges in Italy, and starting in Trieste, I think. And if you're a main draw, you have to be there on the Saturday to go through a mandatory COVID test. And obviously, if not, you don't get to play the tournament. They've obviously changed the main draw to 32 instead of 48, so there's less players on site. And they've brought the qualifying back to 16. If you want to play qualifying, you have to be there on the Thursday to be ready to play on the Saturday. It's all pretty complicated now. But I think my idea is probably just to stay in Italy for like a month to play a tour of the tournaments to make it as simple as possible. And the problem is with the UK is the government's pretty, I don't know if they really know what they're doing.
We understand that here.
So it seems like pretty random the way that some countries now that you come back from, you have to self-isolate 2 weeks, even though we've got worse rates over here than the countries that you have to self-isolate from. I don't think at the moment you have to self-isolate coming back from Italy, but it's changing all the time. So I might even have to go straight from Italy to France and then maybe isolate coming back from France. I mean, if that's changed, but, you know, Greater Manchester now has gone back into lockdown. So they're actually doing it, which is kind of strange in the UK, as you guys know, because it's so small. So they're kind of doing it city by city now. I mean, it's just absolute chaos, which is kind of, I don't know, it feels kind of strange going back to playing proper ATP, you know, challenger events, and with all of this still ongoing, it kind of doesn't feel right in a sense. But I don't know, some guys are saying if we don't start as soon as, you know, as soon as we can, then when do we start again? And I don't know what the response to that is.
I mean, I hate when kind of people bring it up, but I am going to because it matters in this circumstance. We're, you know, you and I are basically similar ranking points right now. When I'm looking at these challengers, I'm like, it's got to be some of the toughest challengers in the world at this point, especially when they cut the draws in half. Especially when you see, Rinka's playing challengers now or whatever the case may be. So it's like, how do you mentally manage to get yourself prepared and ready and to go through all these hoops to fucking play a challenger and then possibly not get in? You know, how do you put yourself in that position?
Well, I mean, that's what kind of... So it was only really last week that I entered the event a few weeks ago. I messed up on the first event's entry because I didn't know you had to enter qualies now. You have to enter qualies separate to main draw. So I decided not to play that first week because I was like 12 out of main and didn't enter qualies. And now, you're kind of looking at the logistics and you have to obviously give, I think you get, is it one member of staff on site per player? So then I have to give all of my coach's details. Obviously, I have to arrange for him to be on site on time for the COVID test. And I have to be on site for the COVID test. And I have no idea what's going to go on with the hotel. Is there going to be a social bubble? This is all sort of stuff that you've got to look into now. And obviously, we're still waiting for French Open as to whether we should book our own accommodation or if there's going to be a bubble for the qualifying players and the main draw players. And I mean, there are just so many... variables right now that I don't think many people really have answers to, which is, again, quite, even for us tennis players who are kind of used to that, it's even more so. It's really strange.
Yeah, you know, I think Mike and I have fully agreed on this even before the pandemic, and now that the pandemic has highlighted it to the max, is that tennis is just way too international of a sport. You know, you talked about really enjoying Battle of the Brits. You know, we had some tournaments in the U.S., but do you think we should have far more tournaments that are just based geographically on your region to limit the travel, have different divisions, let's say, just to make it kind of like, you know, European football and stuff like that? You know, do you think that should be the case?
It's funny because, so, you know, this is probably the longest I've been home in the UK since I was maybe 13 years old,
right?
Which I've actually really enjoyed it, and I just kind of thought it'd be nice if you could have the option to do this and earn a living from playing these events. You know, it's still good tennis, but actually you're probably earning better money playing these events than playing where
without
there's
expenses.
No, yeah, there's no expenses. I mean, you guys know it's sometimes a couple of thousand, maybe 3,000, even if you're bringing a coach, a week in expenses.
Right.
So there's no way that we can earn a living. Whereas actually, I mean, obviously I kind of missed out over the grass court season, but you can actually kind of see, like, geez, like I could actually make a living if the sport was like this. And like you say, I think there's a big opportunity to play more domestic events. And hopefully people will start to realize that, and invest in it, because it is an opportunity.
One thing we've been talking about a lot is the idea of opportunity. I think the thing that makes me love the sport so much, especially at the challenger level, Liam, is the fact that, you know, either of you two guys or your sister, and you can have that run, right? That opportunity to get to the main draw of a slam. You right now, because of the fact you're going to be playing some challengers in Italy, you have that opportunity right now. You could theoretically make the main draw of the Australian Open. You have that opportunity. Noah's in a situation right now where he, frankly, doesn't. How do we reconcile that right now?
You know what? I have no idea, because I don't know the issues that the ATP are having behind closed doors. I don't really go on any of the meetings, because a lot of them you kind of leave with more questions than you have answers.
Let's not get Noah started on Zoom meetings, because that's caused some real issues in the last few weeks.
But it's funny because, I mean, I kind of have sympathy for everyone, you know, like the federations, the AT, you know, all of these organizations, because this is unprecedented. Like, we're living in times that nobody's prepared for. And I guess everybody's trying to do their best. What was the question? I've forgotten now.
How do we make sure that opportunity is equal for everyone in this period of time when some players can't travel?
So what I was kind of, I kind of just assumed that we'd kind of call it quits for the year and then say, look, guys, we start again in Australia. And that way as well, it makes the ranking problem pretty simple as well. We just kind of go again. And we just have a clean slate at the start of the year. But obviously, with the way this is going on now, it seems pretty flawed to me. Like you say, like, there's more opportunities for the European guys. I don't know what the stats are. I think maybe there are more professional tennis players in Europe. But at the same time, if, you know, the US is a powerhouse for tennis as well, and if the US players can't compete, that's completely unfair.
Australia, too. You think about Australia and the fact that they're so isolated.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, I don't know if, like you say, not necessarily, it's hard to put domestic events on, but if you have kind of like North American events or an Asiatic event, but, you know, again, like, tennis is done in Asia for the rest of the year now. I suppose the ATP needs to make money, don't they? That's the problem. So they probably are in a position where they can't call it quits till the end of the year, or if they can, maybe it's not as profitable for them. So I have no idea what the answer is. To me, it seems simplest just to say, guys, let's can it till the end of the year. But then the other problem with that is US and French are just going to go ahead no matter what.
Yeah.
Because, again, these guys are organizations that need the cash flow from the tournament, and they don't give an F about the tour. They need the cash. So then the slams are going ahead, and then if the tour packs in for the rest, it's, I mean, there are so many issues, and I'm just glad that I'm not in charge.
You're so lighthearted about it, though. It's incredible. I mean, you know, you're just like, you know, you're at 200 of the world. You know, this is basically you're the prime ranking that it affects you, and you're like, ah, thank God it's not fucking me.
This has been happening to me for a few years now. I mean, when the transition tour came into effect, I kind of fell through the cracks, and then they got rid of the transition tour, and it kind of like was a negative for me again. So this is, I'm just flowing with the blows now, guys. This is live. We embrace it. But the other thing I'd say is that what would you guys define a professional tennis player as? Because the last month or so, I've made good cash financially.
Mm.
But obviously, it hasn't contributed to my professional ranking at all.
That's a great question.
So then what is your definition of a professional tennis player? Is it someone that can earn a living from the sport, which is what we have probably traditionally said is a professional, which is starts at the top 100. So does that now make me more of a professional player than I was before? Or does me going and spending 10 grand to play 4 challenges in Italy make me a professional tennis player? I don't know what the answer is anymore.
I don't think we can call you a professional tennis player when you're on the BBC flicking off Andy Murray. I mean, at that point, the professionalism is just gone.
It's all relative.
My professionalism reached new lows there. But if you guys could have seen his face, you would have understood.
Worth every.
It was, and you know what? I called my grandma after the match, and I was
I did it, Grandma.
She's a very proper lady. And I said, "Oh, did you watch the match?" She said, "Yes, I did." She said, "You did very well." I said, "Oh, okay." She said, "I also saw you stick your middle finger up." I was like, "I'm so sorry." And she said, "No." She said, "No." She said, "I loved it." She said, "It was great." I was like, "Yes." If my grandma thinks it's great, then that's it. That's the only seal of approval I need.
Grandma, I made you so proud. You would have been proud.
let me ask you a little bit about Andy Murray, though, because when your run in, was it Charlottesville?
Yeah.
What was it, 16, somewhere around there, 15, 16, something like that. And
it was the end of 2014.
14. Okay. I remember you telling me that at that time that Andy was watching some of those matches. That's been true of him for a long period of time, that he cares so much about challenger tennis, British players in particular, and just that progression forward. How has that also then influenced you in terms of how you look at younger British players specifically?
I'll swallow my ego a little bit here and talk about him seriously for a second. I've been so amazed with the way he's carried himself. Obviously, we see him speaking out in the press a lot for people that need to be helped. He's kind of, you know, the champion of the people in a sense. That's the way that I feel about him. But I mean, this last month or two, I mean, he's risked a lot to play, you know, this Battle of the Brits individual event and then the team event. Obviously, as we know, he's recovering from his hip injury. And, you know, he risked his body to help these events, knowing that it would help the other British players. Jamie Murray, again, you know, obviously this was all Jamie's idea as well. And you know, without the Murray brothers, tennis would be in a whole different, British tennis especially, would be in a whole different sort of position. And Jamie made this WhatsApp group and kind of sent everyone a message and said, "Guys, look, I'm thinking about putting this tournament together. Who's interested in playing?" And within half an hour, everybody had replied saying, "Yeah, let's do it." And some of the first guys were Andy and Ebo, which for me, I mean, I think what I've seen is Andy's trying to kind of create a new culture within British tennis. You know, and he said it in his speech. He did a little speech at the end of the team event saying that British players are kind of often seen as being soft. And he said that, you know, this week it kind of would prove a lot of people wrong. And he doesn't have to do any of this, you know. He could take his millions and go and live in his palace and, you know, do whatever he wants. But he's a genuinely good person who is trying to help the state of British tennis, the British game. He cares about the players. He cares about people. And I think, you know, that extends towards the ATP and towards players of all communities as well. He cares about the game, and he's an incredibly intelligent guy who wants to give back. And I think that's so rare in people, because there are people that I have witnessed who, again, you know, it's their right to, who kind of have earned their position and kind of thought, well, you know, I'm just going to look after me, which again, you know, that's completely within people's rights. But he's kind of using his platform and his position to actively help people, and sometimes at his own detriment. Like I said, you know, this Battle of the Brits team event was probably not ideal preparation for his US Open, but he was still out there from dusk till dawn watching, or dawn till dusk watching every single player play, you know, the women's singles, the women's doubles, the men's doubles, the men's singles, the mixed doubles at the end of the day. And it's fantastic for players. I mean, obviously I'm not a young player anymore. I'm 26 years old. You know, I'm getting old. but it's fantastic for players, not only the men, but the women as well, to see, you know, it's okay to be like this. It's okay to enjoy yourself and get involved and create a team atmosphere within an individual sport. And actually, we all benefit from it, because I think tennis has often been a victim in the past of people looking after numero uno. And I think sometimes that's the problem within the ATP. And when decisions aren't getting made, people maybe sometimes look out for themselves instead of the greater good. And I just feel like there could be more. I mean, we would be better off as a sport if there were more Andy Murrays. And it's just a shame there aren't as many.
You know, it's tough to compare the UK to the US just in terms of size. But I think, you know, I've always been jealous, and, you know, taking away a few discrepancies and seeing, you know, Edmund hit Ivo's racket or the few issues that you've had. But I think I've been jealous of the camaraderie between you guys. And I know the US has always been, you know, it's just a tremendous, but we've, you know, finding that team atmosphere and that feel, I don't know what you've seen or felt from the outside looking at Americans, but we're all friendly with each other. We all like each other, but it's just not that same like team atmosphere that you guys have. And you guys, I mean, from like, you know, Josh Ward Hibbert back in the day, like even the juniors and like those guys, like it was just a different feel. And even though some of those had problems, it was, you know, I was always jealous. And I think that's actually helped you guys make a mark in the sport, is because you know, you're helping each other kind of through it when, you know, in actuality, it's a really small country.
Yeah, well, I think Corona maybe was hopefully, in a sense, an eye-opener for a lot of guys. I think maybe just to have a bit of a reality check and say, hang on a second, there are things that are more important than hitting a tennis ball over a net, right? I've been amazed. It's been incredible. There's not been one person that hasn't played their part over this past month or two within the British game. And that includes, you know, the team at the NTC. And Jamie's team that he's assembled. I mean, Jamie has just been an absolute Goliath, the work he's done to put these events on. And everybody's just kind of come together, and maybe more so than they would have done before Corona, but, you know, long may it continue. Even players like, you know, players who may be more introverted and that you wouldn't expect to kind of help out. Again, in that group chat, everybody had replied within half an hour saying, let's do it. You know, everybody's hungry to play, and everybody kind of wants to be a part of something. And it's just been great. And you know, I wish that there were more nations that had that, because, again, I think it would be great for the game. And especially how you're saying, Noah, to have more domestic tours, you probably need leaders like that as well.
Well, as we wrap up here, Liam, I will say I'm disappointed. I look forward to our chats through the summer. You popping into Lexington as you're about to go get drunk at one of the campus bars after busting out of the Lexington Challenger or you know the Aptos the Challenger. We have that balcony where you just sit and heckle me for hours at a time. But I think the followers of your social media, Liam, will want to know. At what point here are you going to be giving up the sport of tennis so that you can become an abs model? I think you've obviously worked so hard on the abs during this COVID time. You know, I think, listen, I'm one of them. I'm a big fan.
Thank you. I mean, you know what? I'm actually flattered, Mike, because I know how much you love Joris Delore.
I do. I have the ultimate man crush on Joris Delore.
We just spoke about this.
He is a specimen, and I think you're eclipsing that at this point, and I'm really proud of you.
No, I mean, I can't handle that pressure. Don't give me that pressure, Mike, because I might take a few bad results, and I'm in KFC. I've got a bottle of wine. The abs will go. Don't give me that, okay? I don't want that title.
This podcast is not finished without a little dose of sexual harassment. It's almost a must on this podcast.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Liam, my best to you and your family. All kidding aside, I've always looked forward to those chats, and I miss having that opportunity to see you and chat with you in person. And you know, I hope things go well and you and your family stay safe. And good luck playing those challengers in Italy over the next few weeks.
Thank you, brother. I wish you guys were there. I miss you guys.
I know. You gotta let us know what happens, though. We're excited to see.
Cheers, guys.
See ya.
The show might be over, but the conversation isn't. Join us on social media at NoahRubin33, at MikeCTennis, and at Behind the Racket.
Expect new episodes every Monday or Tuesday. And don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. It really helps us expand and reach more listeners as we take you behind the racket.